Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. On this extremely warm December day, it's probably like 82 or 3 degrees here in California, which in December, it's always the big question of if we're going to get a really hot spell. You know, it's crazy. They talk about all this global warming bullshit, and you know, at night here, it's been 41 degrees, roughly, and during the day, it's been 85 degrees. So in one day, in one 12-hour, 8-hour period or whatever, our temperature wavered 45 fucking degrees, right? And everyone thinks that the world's going to end if we go up a quarter of a degree. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Anyway, it's not what we're going to talk about today. Today, I'm going to talk about a subject that I know a lot about. You've seen the title already. Consumerism. Or what some schools call conspicuous consumption. Why talk about this? Well, if you've ever been addicted to buying stuff, or you have a relative that's been addicted to buying stuff, and this is probably just shy of hoarding, of course. Hoarding is a whole different disorder, which we're all trying to desperately understand. Yeah, maybe I'll touch on that as well. I have my own theories. But it's the process of buying things to be happy. Buying things to measure yourself by in relation to the rest of society. Buying stuff because you've been sold something about what will make you happy, like commercials. And usually it's always portrayed as, you know, you're buying a big thing, a big house, a big car, something with a gigantic loan. And honestly, you know, that does happen, but for those of you who have suffered from either having this addiction yourself or having a loved one that you love and you see them painfully spending every dime they have, running up gigantic, you know, credit debts, going bankrupt on a routine basis just as quick as the state will allow them to go bankrupt. If any of you have dealt with that, this is an important subject to you. And I have to say, if you haven't run into this, there might be some wisdom that you can share in the comments section to kind of figure out why you don't have this problem. And some of you won't have this problem because you've been through it, and which is what I think I have. I don't really have any super duper history of doing this, but I've had family members and friends of mine who have nearly destroyed their marriages, their lives, as a result of this addiction. And I'll tell you what, I haven't seen anyone buy themselves into happiness. And so when someone says that to you, hey, you know, money doesn't buy happiness. And of course, we're not talking about being destitute, not being able to pay bills. The alternate world to consumerism is a beautiful, simplistic, comfortable survival. And I don't mean survival as in, you know, you're just getting the minimum amount of oxygen to stay alive. No, I'm not talking about that. It's definitely a neutral comfort zone between being impoverished and can't afford to eat, all the way up to, you know, someone being blessed to have millions and perhaps even more dollars and spending it on everything that they thought they ever wanted. And the perspective I'm going to be able to bring you is sort of your normal middle America ability to spend money and become indebted to banks and credit cards and what have you, all the way up to my colleagues and close friends, and even people I've dated who have millions of dollars and have had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to spend to try and make themselves happy. I've seen it. I've seen it personally. I've dated it, you know. And the interesting thing is I think most of them, if they had the opportunity to get on YouTube and make it an episode like this, they would do it because they have learned the hard way that it doesn't really satiate their life. Okay? And the reason to talk about it is the reason to understand a little bit more than just the surface problems with the whole thing. And it's really tough to initially approach the idea. It really is. You're kind of going, well, geez, what can I do? I don't want to sound preachy or whatever. And I don't want to say a bunch of basically stupid, obvious stuff. Not stupid, obvious, but just painfully obvious stuff, right? You'd be surprised that farmers are some of the richest people in small towns, but they make millions, but they spend millions. And so it kind of balances out. You know, they don't, and you never really go up to a farmer's place and find some super lavish home. You just don't. They've got to buy gigantic combines and millions of dollars worth of seed and all kinds of wild, you know, labor force and stuff. The cool thing about the Midwest is that when we're kids, they read us these prairie books, or at least they used to, when I was a kid in the 70s. And so we got to hear stories about, you know, what it was like to settle the Midwest back in the 1800s. And when you hear these stories, you hear about families that are utterly destitute. They're a fish out of water. There is no true civilization yet, you know. They're, you know, freshly acquired land, unfortunately, from the Native Americans, and they're farming and going through all their stuff, right? You know, the only sugar they see is a couple times a year when it's one of the kids' birthdays or it's Christmas or something, and someone goes in and gets literally like a cup of sugar so they can make one cake. You know, that's why they didn't die with, you know, missing teeth. And so you get this amazing bird's eye view of what made them happy. And, you know, there's all kinds of stories that lament about how simplicity can be the most amazing thing. And that's what I think we've lost sight of once marketing departments, pretty much in the 20th century, really started getting their claws into folks. And it existed in the 19th century as well, but it, without newspapers and radio and television and movies, they were not able to penetrate us on so many levels, at so many intervals, right? Think about the average amount of advertising a child sees in a three-hour session on Saturday morning watching cartoons, and then compare that to what perhaps a year's worth of advertising might have been for grown adults in, say, 1880 in the Midwest. The child would win the race in 3 hours, being told you got to buy this and you got to buy that, right? And that sort of brings me to the other subject, which is, if you're a single person, you're fighting the battle by yourself. You're fresh out of perhaps your parents' house. You've maybe finished your college, or you're not going to go to college or whatever, and you're just chilling out. And you kind of built up some dreams, right? And we see our lives usually in decades. We see our 0 to 10 in our brain, and our 11 to 19 in our brain. Maybe we split 11 to 19 at right around 13 because you start, you know, hitting puberty or whatever. Then you see your 20s and your 30s and your 40s. And that's just how you divide up your life to essentially file away in your filing cabinet of your brain the experiences that you've had. So in this particular video, I want you to view the lusts that you've built for items pre-teen years, your teenage years, and then your 20s. Because it is really those first, I would say, 20 years where you start to build up your biases of what car is going to be your favorite car, what clothing is your favorite clothing, you know. You do develop new ones, trust me. But then you start dating people and sharing your space with people. And one of the big giant levels of compatibility that I think people are becoming aware of is how addicted to consumerism is this potential partner of mine. And you really need to sync that shit up, because if they want it, a lot of stuff, and you're content, it'll be a nightmare. It'll be a nightmare trying to push it all together. And then you finally find your mate, and then you have children. Now, if you match up with your mate well, and you guys are either both very simplified or you're both total crazy consumers, then your children are going to invariably be exactly what you are. But if you're out of sync with your spouse or your partner and you happen to have a child, then you might really have a problem because your child will either emulate you, and one of the parents will feel like, oh my gosh, you know, now I feel broken. There's two of them and only one of me. You know, one of the biggest problems in society is the parent has a really bad habit. A lot of cases I see it in obesity. And the parent wants the child to be obese so that we're all in this club together. Alcoholism is another one. Parent doesn't know how to really grow up. So drinking alcohol is passed on to the child as this is what it means to be an adult. But I want to put this really early in your brain in this episode, which is the following. There's all this talk about slavery in history. Slavery, oh, I was a slave, you were owned slaves or whatever. To the degree you are addicted to having something that you really don't need to have, you're a slave to it. And it will consume your time, your thought, your money, your mind. I mean, it is just, it could be all-consuming. Now, for those of you who struggle with drug addiction, man, you know this better than anyone. But I would say consumerism is a drug, 100%. There's a trigger in your brain that fires when you buy something. And then when you have it, it's nearly impossible to get that trigger to fire one more time. Now, there are exceptions, but I'm going to go through a few of these items just to make sure you understand. People who I know who've had things that are outrageously amazing very quickly fell out of love with those amazing things. And no matter how many times they bought another one or experienced something, it just didn't work. It did not make them happy. So let's go through a few of these things. Now I'm going to start big and we're going to go small because I think when I say consumerism, most people think about the big items. Big fancy cars. Men like them and women like them. The more expensive the car is, the more expensive it is to maintain it. And a lot of folks have chances to upgrade from very inexpensive cars, $15,000 to $20,000 cars, up to $60,000 to $100,000 cars, or even more. And they are utterly and completely shocked of what it costs to put a license plate on the car, to change the oil, change the brakes, to deal with an accident. I dated someone I mentioned in a previous episode. I go into her house, and I don't know anything that's coming in this experience. And I go over to her place, and it's a very nice place in a very nice neighborhood, but nothing, you know, tremendously amazing. And she says to me, you know, could you grab a box out of the garage for me and take it upstairs? Because my back's hurting me. I've been doing a lot of lifting. I just moved into this place. I said, yeah, sure, no problem. So I go in the garage, open the door, and there's a Lamborghini Huracane 2015, staring right at me. And I'm looking at this girl going, what? Like, she's a single girl. She'd been married before. Very young, younger than me. And she's got this $230,000 car in the garage. And so she kind of looks at me and she goes, yeah, you know, I'm a car snob. I really like nice cars. And so I'm looking at her going, yeah, you know, I have a lot of friends who are car snobs too, but they don't own cars that cost, you know, a third of my house, you know. Take the box upstairs. Over the course of several months, we dated, and turns out she had been married to a very wealthy man, a very intelligent woman, a wonderful person. And she had had access to money on a level that I would say, honestly, of all the people I've had the privilege to sit down with and talk to, more money than anyone I've ever talked to. And I've talked to people worth $500 million and even more. But I mean, I've met billionaires, but you just say hi and shake hands and they go away, or you don't sit around talking to them very much. But she had more access. She had access to more money than any of the people I know intimately, meaning in a good, deep friendship. And she was the most educational person I've dated, where she taught me things. She had been around the world countless times, been in places that none of us can get access to, just due to, you know, you need a lot of wealth to even take a one day of vacation there. And she wasn't a person that flaunted it, really. She liked to wear nice things and she had a nice house and stuff, but she was sort of done with it because she'd been there. She was able to purchase anything she wanted in the world at any point in time, travel anywhere she wanted to at any point in time. And she did. She really likes traveling and she's a very strong-minded person, which is great. But she had just moved out of a home that was essentially almost, I would say about 35,000 square feet in a very, very posh, amazing place down here in Southern California. You know, the house was valued at nearly $30 million. It did not sell for that because they just wanted to get rid of it because they were getting divorced. Garage downstairs had a 24-car garage, I believe, with every single exotic car you could possibly imagine down there. And I mean everything. It looked like a little mall. I've seen photographs of this place. The house above was just unbelievable. She got a chance to design most of it. Turned out great. So then I started asking her. I said, you know, what was it like to live in this place? She said, I instantly hated it. The second we moved in, I couldn't believe I got a chance to design it exactly the way I wanted to based on a general floor plan. And she said, I never saw my husband. She goes, it was so large, I rarely ever went to certain, you know, areas of the house. I felt alone constantly. It took so many servants to keep the place dust-free that she could never be alone in her own home. I mean, she couldn't, like, just walk out of the bathroom without a towel on and go to her bedroom, dry, you know, and dress slowly. She always had to be covered up. She had to close the door. It was like being in a hotel. And the place she bought, I don't know. Maybe it's 2,500 square feet. And she felt cozy, and it was great. And you might think, well, she had a Lamborghini. Okay. You're not supposed to put that many miles on a Lamborghini unless you're literally, you know, like a billionaire who can just use these things up like, you know, big shavers, right? You're supposed to put no less, you know, on average, you're not supposed to put more than about 2,500 miles on a Lamborghini per year because they're very expensive to fix, even though the reliability, I guess, in the last 10 years has been greatly enhanced. One of the guys I smoke with, he's a 28-year-old prodigy who fixes exotic cars. His whole family's been fixing exotic cars for decades. And we will sit and watch, you know, exotic car videos and stuff, reviews, and he just sits there and cringes. And I'm like, well, what's up with that car? And he's like, oh my God, that car barely can stay running. And if coincidentally, he said most of the Lamborghinis from 2005 and back, especially like the famous Countaches and what have you, because keeping these cars running at all throughout the year is next to impossible. You need to be shoveling, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 into the cars like every year just to keep the engine starting. I mean, it's just really bad, right? But the interesting thing about this friend of mine that I was able to date for a little while, she really kind of in an indirect way said, you know, at no point with all this stuff was I, you know, absolutely thrilled. She loved traveling. She loved seeing the world. That was probably the best part of what she was able to do. And they traveled in a really big way. You know, we're talking about probably a 100-foot yacht for like 3 people, that sort of thing. And it was a huge eye-opener for me because I had grown up as a kid in a world where as much as we could as Midwesterners and as like normal human beings trying to sort of have the finest things that we loved, you know. So in the 80s, one of the biggest things was home theaters. It was your physical stereo to portray the sound, and then it was your TV, and then it was your VCR, and it was, you know, beta, then super beta, then VHS, then super VHS, or whatever. And of course, there was the laser discs and the DVDs and that kind of thing, and the Blu-rays, etc. I had moved out long before DVDs came out, but that was the focus. And then I moved to California, and I met, I'll just say, some of my mentors, who are extremely wealthy people. I went to their house, and, you know, I worked with some of these folks for like 20 years, and I go to their house, and they have very nice things. Don't get me wrong, very nice things. The only difference is they'll have like a Barcelona chair, you know, made in, you know, the 40s, and they still have it, and it's immaculate. They take good care of it. They have beautiful items in their house that look wonderful, but they bought them very slowly over 30 to 40 years, and they treat them beautifully. And I would go into their laboratory where they create imagery for film, and the computers were very nice, but not always brand new. And you would think that if your game is to use art supplies or what have you, that you might always get the best of the best. And there was definitely some areas where the best of the best was purchased on a daily basis, but you would be much more subtle than you might think. And I'm going to share with you one thing that my friend Sid Mead has talked about several times in public, because he's a good man to use when you think about consumerism. And his partner Roger is the same way. Essentially, what they say is, look, what is the task that's at hand here? What are we trying to do? And this is going to be a business thing, but you could think about this as your home thing as well, because they carry the philosophy into their homes as well. The thing he's warned people about is the tech trap. And the tech trap is where a lot of men run off and spend a tremendous amount of money trying to get the best of the best of the best, thinking that somehow buying the most fancy guitar, the most fancy woodworking tools and stuff, and tools, you know, just your average toolbox, is going to make you a great mechanic. It's going to make you understand things a lot better. And indeed, you do need something. But I will tell you that the sort of amazing, erotic thing is if you can buy a really cheap tool and get it done. Yeah, it might break, but hey, at that point, you haven't spent that much money. Go get another one. But maybe you never have to do that task again. But Sid is a painter. He does gouache painting, which is a very elaborate form of watercolors that is not like watercolors when you and I were a kid. It's actually photoreal paintings. And where he spends his money is on the quality of the paint. There's a very specific brand he buys, and there's a very specific brand of brushes that he buys. And he spends a tremendous amount of money on his fine brushes, I should say. And they're made of, you know, the tail hair of llamas and yaks and stuff. It's just, it's so fine. It's organic, and so it doesn't split badly. He's got brushes with a couple follicles out of the end, because he paints things so teeny tiny that when you zoom them up 200 or 300 times, it would still be difficult for the average painter to paint it with any brush. The computers that he uses, because he's also an amazing Photoshop guy, is just whatever needs to be there. His version of Photoshop is the version of Photoshop that does what he needs it to do. And regardless of Adobe updates a million times, he's like, look, I just need to fill these shapes with colors. I need to be able to do some blurring, some layering, and I'm done. And honestly, if any of you have ever played in Photoshop, you'll know that despite the years and decades of promised updates and what have you, nothing's really changed. I mean, I've been using that tool for 20 years as an expert, and I'm telling you, I use the same tools that I've been using for years, right? And, you know, when I inherit files from young students, they're still using the same stuff. There's no like, oh my God, I'm totally incompatible with the way people are drawing in Photoshop. Nope. It's all the same stuff. So he saves a tremendous amount of money, and he also saves a tremendous amount of focus. He stays focused on what he needs to focus on to get his job done. And just before I close off the professional side of this whole thing, a lot of times you'll buy the latest and greatest things, and they're absolutely complicated. And so you lose your art into the manuals and the how the hell do you do this suite of things. I used to write music a lot in the 90s, and used to do a lot of contract work for video games and for personal projects of people, weddings and stuff, just some ambient music for commercials, all kinds of stuff. And I used to use this product called MasterTrax Pro on the Macintosh. It was very simple. It was black and white, you know, it was before the color interfaces, and you just load it up, You'd MIDI everything. It saved everything. It had all the quantifying algorithms to kind of fix problems and cut and pasting your songs. Very similar to today. And then they stopped making that product. And so I went off and got Pro Tools. And immediately things got really complicated. And of course, sound engineers who go to college, they are taught right into that product. And so they understand all the ins and outs that make this thing happen. Of course, now we, you know, write music with all the instruments in our computers, which is fantastic. So it's been resimplified. But there was an interesting thing that happened because I spent a tremendous amount of money, probably 50 grand, upgrading my instruments, my mixing boards, my software, carved inside my computer itself, all this kind of stuff. And I got absolutely inundated with what Sid Mead talks about, which is the tech trap. He was 100% correct. So when I heard him say tech trap about 10 years later, I was like, oh my God, that's me. And there was an interesting interview with Prince, the musician, somewhere in the 90s. And he was going through a very tough transition where most of his work in the 70s and early 80s was all with a multi-track recording where he had to play it all live. And this is where he would layer himself over and over and over, his voice, his instruments, all that good stuff. But by the time he hit the 1999 album and probably even Controversy, and then all the way up to probably the early 90s, he was relying on software. And I don't know what software he used, but he had mastered it. He mastered his beat machines and sequencers and all that stuff. And he was just cranking out music left and right. Some of the best stuff he's ever made, right? And then he transitioned about the Diamonds and Pearls album into playing everything live again. And I believe the interview that I heard was essentially saying that he said, look, I got so inundated with trying to understand my software that I said, screw this. I'm just going to grab a regular sound engineer with a mixing board. I'm going to make them do all the hard work. I'm going to play everything live again like I did in the 70s. And he actually said something to the effect of, I really became a musician for the very first time in the 90s, where he really felt like he was playing jazz, like he was really up to sort of a sophisticated level of music. He kind of looked back on his past, and even though obviously he created amazing music in the past, like legendary songs, he felt like that was consuming a tremendous amount of his time using the hardware and the software to make what was like Purple Rain, like Let's Go Crazy, amazing song, right? Super layered, super amazing. He plays most of all the instruments, if not all of them. But he started surrendering that control to get back to his roots, to get back to his heart. The simplification out of consumerism for him as a solution to his business gave him the gift that he was always looking for, which is to play more like probably his father, who was a master pianist and jazz player. So I thought that was pretty cool. But I know for a fact, whatever software he was using in the 90s didn't exist 10 years later. I mean, the name of the product existed, but he would have had to, you know, get the next version and learn all the features in the next version, right? But let's come back to the home, and let's just take the algorithm of buying something. Because of those of you who've ever watched the show Hoarders, you've seen this algorithm several times, which is this sort of, you wake up bored, is usually how it works, which means you might have a 9-to-5 job and you haven't really considered having a hobby besides watching sports or you know, maybe interacting with your friends, which is great, but your friends aren't always available, sports aren't always on, and even if they are on, It's sort of a single gender game, right? It's not a lot of wives want to sit down with their husband and watch, you know, 6 hours worth of sports. Some of you do, some of you don't. My travels, it's been very few females want to dedicate any amount of time to that. There'll be like a championship game or some important local rivalry game that you want to watch. But after that, you know, let's go live life. So like George Carlin said, you know, America turned into a mall nation. Everyone went to the mall to be entertained, to look in the windows at things you can't afford, from jewelry to like a Bang & Olufsen stereo system that's going to run, you know, $80,000 for your house, for just your front room. And then you come away with something that you can purchase, which is sort of, in a lot of cases, for at least a man, and I think it happens for females as well, you know, you're addicted to Louis Vuitton or something like this, it's, I am successful enough to have these things. And it's a measurement of yourself. You've externalized your inner value to an outer value system. Obviously, very quickly, you either burn through your savings and you lose. Imagine you buy one Louis Vuitton bag. That's a trip for two to Hawaii for a week. Easily. Easily. The tickets, the hotel stay, you know, $3,500 to $5,000. Easy. Boom. So you have this leather bag now. And yeah, they go up in value. You can hold them forever as long as you don't break them. You can usually sell them off and get your money back at a minimum, usually a lot more. But it could be a huge sacrifice. But what about places that, you know, like Targets? Fry's Electronics. For those of you who haven't been to America, we have this chain of electronic stores called Fry's. And boy, do they have 1,000 things. Consequently, one of the most entertaining things I ever did in England was walk into the stores, the sort of, the name escapes me, I'm sorry. It's like their Target, and walk around and look at all the different products. That was really entertaining, just as the mystery of what things are called and what kind of brands exist over there that don't exist here, you know. Trippy, I got this squirrel sitting about 10 feet behind me, just in the middle of my yard, just playing around the leaves. Really funny. But what's the algorithm, right? You go in and you see something that looks fun that you can mess around with. And you buy it. And you're so excited at the concept of having this as a possession. And you get home. And what I find is that most people rarely use the item very quickly. It's interesting. Let's say you go and buy a really big purchase. You buy a Les Paul guitar from Guitar Center here in California. Well, you bring it home. Maybe you have an amp all set up, some software, whatever. You plug it in and you play. And then you got to go eat dinner. You know, you got to get back into life a little bit. You got to go to bed. You got to go to work. Got to go to school, whatever. And you put it back in the case and you just look at it and you're like, oh my God, that's so beautiful. I got a Les Paul. Unreal. And the next day, you try to get it out again, and you play a little bit more. But unless you're in a band, unless you're writing music, unless you're trying to upgrade what you're doing, it's just this thing. And invariably, the death blow to you ever learning how to play the guitar or becoming a regular player is you buy the little white mount for your wall because you want all your friends to know that you've got a Les Paul, and you want to be perceived as this musician, and so you hang it on the wall. And the second you hang something on the wall is the last time you'll ever play it. It's unbelievable. All kinds of these folks in LA. And you go in their house and you look at the whatever it is, the acoustic guitar, the bass guitar, whatever's on the wall, and you go, so you play that? Oh, well, you know, I used to. And you find out that they played it for maybe 5 hours out of the 2 years they owned it. And when they hung it on the wall, it was essentially the death blow. Now, what's funny about this whole thing is that you will have watched perhaps a hoarding show. And again, for those of you who've never seen a hoarding show or really never really heard about this concept, is that individuals who, they buy tons of stuff. They bring it home. And they put it down and they rarely ever look at that item ever. And their house is usually full of tons of sealed bags from their favorite stores, like Target or Walmart or whatever. It's usually fairly inexpensive things, but they buy so many of these things, they never have any money. They'll have like 8-foot piles in their homes, stacked literally to the ceiling, and they have to create corridors, you know, to walk through their own homes, right? So I watch friends who watch these shows, and they'll agonize over this horrible pattern this person has and how, you know, filthy their homes are in a lot of cases. But on a micro level, they're doing kind of the exact same thing. They buy things they don't need. And they'll, a lot of times, buy their memories from the past. And we're all guilty of this. I bought old classic computers and you mess with them for a little while. You realize that they're really ancient and you wouldn't really spend any time with them. People buy old Atari 2600 home console games, the whole console and the games, and they'll try to find a little adapter so they can see it on their flat screen TV, and they'll play it, and then, you know, 10 minutes into it, they're like, this is really sucky. This is really bad. I have a relative of mine who bought the, he bought a sort of a carnival vending machine where you put the little coin in, which is usually says like Six Flags on it or what have you, put it in there, and you can pound out letters on the outer rim of your name, the date, so that you can take home kind of a relic from the park. But this person bought the whole machine and then bought a bunch of blank coins, put it in the living room. Yeah, it's kind of a neat little thing to have in the living room. If you just know, it's just a piece of furniture, a little bit of decor to make the thing look great. And I guess you could say, I've been to this person's house by pounding out a coin. You know, it was kind of interesting. But it's probably one of the most unequivocal, useless things you could ever buy for your house. And it was definitely an homage to this person's past, because they really appreciated their youth. And when these machines were in parks, they loved it. In moderation, you could do those things. You'd be all right. But the idea is, if you buy something, you're going to be happy. And invariably, that's never the case. You know, if you're buying the staple items, a good sofa, a good bed, maybe a great TV, a good computer because you use a computer a lot, that's a little bit different. Those are utilities for your very existence in your own home. I have, in the last year, upgraded my vehicle. And I was fortunate enough to upgrade to a very nice vehicle. The previous vehicle I had owned for, 9 years. And it started having a lot of engine problems, and it was leaking oil, and it was on its last leg. So I needed to get a new car. And I bought a car that was probably 4 times as much as my other car. In the short term that I've owned this brand new car, that's, I think, is phenomenal and gorgeous and all this other stuff, I realized, well, if I'd had my head out of my ass, I probably would have bought a car maybe 50% more than my other car. I've had someone scratch the hood real bad. I've had someone rear end me and bend my rear exhaust pipe. Another drunk guy run into my rear left wheel. I've had a giant bolt or something pound my windshield and put a 3-inch star on my windshield. Huge. The worst impact I've seen on anyone's car, save an actual accident. And I'm sitting there going, geez, I've always had brand new cars since I was 18 years old. When I started having the financial control over my own life, I had one car for 5 years. I had one car I still own. It's 25 years old. And it's actually 24 years old this month. And I've had one other car that I owned for 9 years, and I got rid of it and replaced it with this one. I've never had so many problems trying to keep my car decent. This thing's a magnet for people to fucking run into, right? The car makes me happy on one level. I like getting into a fine vehicle. But now I know to repair all this stuff, it's going to cost me, you know, a good coin. License plates, registration went way up. Still under warranty. It's running really well, of course. It's only a year old. But when it does hit its 60,000 mile mark, or it's, like it's a 10-year bumper to bumper, it's going to cost a lot of money to keep this thing going. A lot of money. The tires alone are expensive. The brakes are going to be expensive. And so I didn't really think it through. I had a very fortunate financial situation last year, and I committed myself to this vehicle as a mechanism to keep myself riveted to my career and keep pushing forward. So I used it sort of as a psychological pressure mechanism to say, you got to make this amount of money because this is your new responsibility. And you're going to have 2 or 3 years, maybe even 4 years of great coverage on your car, so you're not going to be incurring the lion's share of the expenses. But now I can already tell it's going to take a lot to get this thing back to the way it was when I drove it off the lot because of all the morons hitting my car. But here's a cycle I want you guys to know about. And for those of you who are probably over 40, and you've been through this process, if you've done this before 40, I'm going to tell you, you're ahead of the game. If you've never run into this, which I'm going to mention a group in LA that hasn't run into this, you have already programmed yourself to win your whole life. If you were in your 20s in the 90s or older, you probably were swept away with some of this consumerism because the malls were just being built by the dozens, and we had products on the market that we'd never seen before. Choices, you know, it was like when I was a kid and you wanted to buy a candy bar, you went to the store and man, there was maybe like a dozen, maybe, and now there's like five dozen choices. And so part of it is just, well, let's try this one out, let's try that one out. And it's every genre of everything, computers, telephones, everything, right? But sooner than later, you will come out of that coma and understand that this stuff is never really making you happy like you want to be happy. And so you start to realize that the things that make you happy are sort of damn near the free stuff. Companionship, a good meal is a good meal. Sometimes good meals cost a lot of money, sometimes they don't. It's one of those things when you get to the end of the month, you don't have any money left, and you're like, damn, where did it all go? And you look at your sushi bill, and you're like, Jesus, okay, I figured it out now. One of the things that Americans don't do as much as we used to is travel. And the main reason behind this, in my opinion, is because we're dying of microtransactions. Buy something for a buck, buy something for $5. You know, those little apps on your telephone, right? You know, people play games like Clash of Clans on their telephones, and they will literally pay $10 to finish like the construction of a little virtual building in a game that is geared to destroy you no matter how much money you spend. You could be a prince of Dubai and put $1 million into Clash of Clans, and you will get your entire village wiped out by the next kid, because that's how they roll. They always punish you down so you have to spend more money. That's how the game works, right? So in America, we start becoming not necessarily xenophobic, which means, you know, afraid of people outside of our planet. We just don't have the intimate knowledge because we can't get there. We can't afford it. And so we travel within the borders of our own country if we travel at all. We'll go down the street. You know, when you live in Southern California, it is tough to find places that will eclipse, you know, the general quality of life. The weather is fantastic here. We have a lot of scenery. And if you want to go to the most beautiful beaches, just drive 3 miles that way, you know. But you can go off to Hawaii and various exotic islands in the Bahamas and get better views. But that costs a tremendous amount of money because it costs you two things, right? It costs you to get to the vacation, but also you have to pay for everything back here, depending on how far you go. You got to pay rent even though you're not here. Some of you are self-employed. You simply will not earn any money when you're not working. That becomes an issue, right? But there's a simplification phase that starts to happen in your 40s where you start to go, look, I don't need all this crap. In fact, I don't want to have a house with all this crap in it. Because you start thinking, well, what if I had to move? You know, what if the economy crashed, or if you're a renter, you know, your landlord doesn't want to rent the house anymore and you had to pick up all your stuff and leave? Well, if you have a simplified life, that move might be a few U-Haul trucks or maybe even one U-Haul truck from point A to point B and you're good. If you own a whole house full of stuff, now you're renting a semi and you're hiring a big moving company. It could be $3,000 or $4,000 just to move down the street because you have so much stuff. You don't want it to get all messed up, so you don't want to hire just these starving students. You need to have really bonded workers that if they drop your priceless thingy-majiggy, you have some liability to get it replaced or at least financially get compensated, right? On my old show, MK Ultra Radio, my co-host and I, Kyle, we've talked about this at length, of the simplification of life. Here's the beauty of simplification. The one thing that you get, well, you get two actually wonderful things, believe it or not. The most important thing is control. You get control over your life, you get control over your money, and you start to understand that you no longer get manipulated by marketing like you used to. In fact, you know, for those of you who've pulled out a television, you know that you have deconsumerized yourself because you're no longer being fed this algorithm of, boy, if you don't have this, you're not as good as your neighbor, or you're not going to be as happy as you possibly could be before you die. But the other thing that comes with control is happiness. you will become extremely happy to be alive. And that's important, right? Isn't that what we're all trying to do? Find a perfect balance. You wake up in the morning, you have everything that you need. You have quality items for the things that are imperative, your strategic resources. You have more money to buy better food, non-GMO food, non-fluoridated toothpaste. You can afford a water filter on your whole house, not just the front, you know, faucet. And you start to gain more health, more peace of mind. And you start to undo this sort of subconscious feeling that you're a sucker, that you can't control yourself. Someone else controls you. And it is a beautiful thing. But if you start experiencing this in your 40s, you'll definitely be happy. But one of the interesting side effects is that you start to regret ever being in this game. You start to reimagine your 20s if you hadn't bought into all this consumerism, and your 30s or what have you. Have you ever had an addiction to something that you spent money on routinely? For guys that smoke a lot of Cuban cigars, I guarantee there's a moment in their life where they find themselves perhaps in a financial tough spot, and in their brain they think, wow, what if I had all the money back that I spent on Cuban cigars? And they start to realize, geez, I would probably have 10 grand in the bank. It could be you're addicted to fancy coffees, and you start to look at, you know, your bills you can't pay, and you're thinking, geez, what if I had all the money back for the cappuccinos and the lattes and the espressos? And you start to think, geez, I would have 6 grand in the bank just for this year. For any of you who use budgeting software like QuickBooks or something like that, or Quicken, and they can tell you, once you categorize all your expenses, how much you've blown. When you're young, sometimes you don't understand that this is what's happening to you, which is why I want to mention it. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't buy nice things. What I'm probably saying is buy very nice things, but buy limited amounts of them. Make them your strategic resources, the things that make you really happy. Like a great bed is a good one because you get a good night's sleep. Perhaps you want to spend it on clothing that's really high quality clothing that you don't have to replace every single year because it rots away when, you know, Tide disintegrates your clothing. I've been informed that Tide is the most volatile soap you can use on your clothing. I have some friends that work in high-end clothing stores, and they say, whatever you do, never use Tide. It eats up the fabric, it eats up the threading that holds your clothes together, and you will have to replace your clothing all the time. Now, there's a new generation that's coming about that is, I guess you could call it the Gen Zers. And in Los Angeles, there's kind of this movement. I'm not sure how potent it is today, but I would say 10 years ago, I would bump into these kids in their early 20s to mid-20s, and they were wearing clothing that was made a long time ago. They got it not necessarily thrift stores. In fact, someone might pay a lot of money to get some of this clothing, but they refuse to wear expensive watches. They refuse to be caught dead with anything that would cost a lot of money. It was sort of this anti-consumerism movement that I think a lot of these folks are going to take into their 30s. And they're able to travel. They're able to have nice things. If they want to buy a nice car, they conservatively look around to see which cars are most reliable as well as inexpensive. Or if they are expensive, you know, what does the maintenance look like? Are the previous owners of this particular model happy with it? Does it have good consumer reviews? And so we're seeing kind of a turn that I haven't seen in my lifetime. In the Midwest, something really interesting happened in the 70s, which I was actually capable of seeing because I had grandparents that had one code of ethics and one upbringing. And again, my grandparents were 10 years apart from each other, meaning on one side of my family, my father's family, his parents were 10 years older than my mother's family. And so my father's mother and father grew up through the Depression. And boy, did that forever scar them in a way that said, only buy quality items, only buy the items if you need them, and absolutely positively use them up before you replace them. Make sure they can no longer function before you rationalize getting a new one. You don't need a new one just because you want a new one. You need a new one because the old one doesn't work anymore. And then even my grandparents that grew up See, one of my grandparents were born in the teens, 1910 and 1912. My other grandparents were born in, I believe, 1920 and 1923. Both sets of them never got caught up in this consumerism. And I think it may have been due part to the Depression, but it also had to do with simply not being inundated much by marketing. And one of my grandparents, sets of grandparents, I should say, had quite a bit of money that was earned through decades of previous generations saving money, and they had a lot of land, and they still do to this day, even though they're passed away. But you went to their house, and they had just an average television, average furniture, and they had to raise five kids as well. But even when the kids were gone and they were just bathing in their own annuities, their house was normal all the way to their death in their 70s. And then I watched my parents, which were kind of split down the middle. One of my parents is very conservative and, again, doesn't buy anything unless it's necessary. And one of my parents was really into buying the latest and greatest things. And eventually it drove them apart, because there was an incompatibility of consumerism and the debt that comes with such a thing. And so it was all a very valuable lesson for both sides of the fence, and both of them, well, obviously one of them just continued their conservative regimen, while the other side learned their lesson and calmed down a little bit, you know? And so I was able to see the sort of baby boomer generation walk right into all the consumerism and get eaten alive by it, as well as all the other baby boomer parents that were the parents of my friends, right? And so what I was able to see was that happiness was in the more conservative realm of thinking and spending. And the one that went off and spent a tremendous amount of money was in constant strife, incurred a bankruptcy that was embarrassing, and when you have to reset from scratch, it's an ass kicker, because you kind of have that scar on your finances. You can't just go buy what you want. The bank rejects loans. If you're applying to live somewhere or work somewhere, sometimes they would care whether or not you've ever been bankrupt to see what kind of person you are, which is now a very horrific thing. Today, they always check, and there's certain government jobs you can't have because they just look at you and say, well, you're a person that doesn't believe you should pay your debt to society when you borrow money from banks, right? Now, again, we have no love for banks on this show, but it's not, you know, as corrupt as banks are, it's still our responsibility to spend our money wisely and not drive up interest rates, because we're constantly making the banks eat our bad habits, right, through bankruptcies, right? Consequently, you need to know in America that the bankruptcy laws have been rewritten in this country such that you really don't have the ability to bankrupt like you used to. So for those who have been using the bankruptcy mechanism to constantly refresh every 10 years or whatever interval they can't run away from it anymore like they used to. Now, if you run it through a business, I guess it's still pretty good. You can totally bankrupt and walk away from everything. But you'd have to create an LLC of some sort to protect yourself, and then you'd have to somehow convince the state or the country that you're able to purchase everything that you need through your company. A lot of times you'll pierce your own company veil, your corporate veil, by buying products for yourself that have no business being in your business, and then you can get in a lot of trouble that way. So you can no longer run away like you used to. And some people might view that as bad, and some people might view that as good. Ross Perot said something very interesting when he was running for president in the early 90s here in America. He said, you know, and this guy's a billionaire, three times over. And he said, you know, saving up for what you want to buy is probably more fun than actually buying the product that you actually end up with. And when he first said that, I was like, how can that even be possible? And now that I've done it several times, he's completely right. You know, I've owned, four cars. I've owned four cars in my lifetime. Three of them I've gone through loans to buy the cars, and one of them I just paid cash. And there was nothing better than to be in an economic crash of 2008, subprime loan bullshit, and I owned my car. And so I could do full coverage insurance, I could do liability insurance. I never had a car payment, which was nice. Consequently, I got really bad treatment at the dealership because I wasn't going to eat their loan. Gene Simmons of Kiss. Obviously, he's done very well for himself at a very early age with the band Kiss, and so he's had a lot of money. But at the same time, he said, look, I only buy what I can afford with cash, and you should do the same. Now, again, if you want to buy a home or, again, a car, sometimes you don't have that kind of money sitting around. But if you can keep everything else in your life that are not these giant, giant items, which usually cost an arm and a leg, if you can buy everything else, your sofa, your TV, with cash, your computer, whatever, you have no debt. And let me tell you, when you go through a financial crisis, you'll thank your lucky stars that that's what you did. Consumerism is also important because how many people really talk to you about this subject? You know it's a subject. Every time you buy something, you think about the wisdom of buying something. You know, little tiny items, no. And that's where we get in America. Today, we're sitting on Amazon and we're just buying a bunch of crap we don't need. Malls are starting to die in America, thank God. And I don't want necessarily home-owned businesses to go out of business, but I wouldn't mind if a couple corporations folded. I wouldn't mind if a few fast food chains folded. But they're so cheap, right? When I go to my hometown, which I've talked about several times, one of the biggest problems is that Walmart has destroyed all the local businesses because they can sell paper towels for cheaper, food for cheaper. That's obviously, sometimes paper towels are paper towels, but a lot of times food is not always just food. The organic, beautiful stuff that you can buy from a local merchant or a restaurant owner that believes in healthy food, it's going to cost more than the ones that are fast food joints. So what if you saved your money and didn't buy a bunch of crap you didn't need? Then you could afford to buy products from your local community. And this goes for everywhere in the entire world. Keeping the money in your neighborhood because it goes to your neighbor and then they spend it on another neighbor and then it comes back to you because they buy your services and the same money goes in a nice little circle. Well, if you go to a big giant corporation, the money goes overseas typically, away from your country, away from your neighborhood. You have choices. I don't know about you, but when you wake up with when I wake up with any type of loan over my head, it's pressure. It's stress. Now, you may be able to, you know, comfortably pay your bills and you're fine. But again, when someone says, oh my God, I think the bond market's going to fall out in 2018 because of George Soros betting against everything, you know, succeeding. And you look at that loan on your house, or your car, or your computer, or whatever the hell you're borrowing money for, it becomes a whole different headline in your mind. Oh my God, am I going to lose my ability to charge for my work, right? I want you guys to have control over your life. I want you guys to be happy. I want you guys to be financially secure. And I'll tell you this, some of you are going to listen to this and you haven't gotten yourself in over your head yet. And good for you. Hang on to whatever the hell you're doing that keeps you in that status. But if you find yourself listening to this and you're, oh my God, that is exactly my problem, it's okay. It's all right. Because one of the things you could do very easily in this world is stop doing what you've been doing, right? And again, like Ross Perot said, why don't you look at your entire household and say, okay, what am I addicted to buying that I don't need to buy? Maybe I don't go to the mall all the time to buy anything. I just go to look. I mean, it's your first detox out of spending your money on everything. And every time you walk out of the mall and you don't buy anything, and in fact, I've had situations where I've been destitute at times, and I would go to these malls, and I would just look, and I'd walk out, go to Fry's, and I'd walk around, and I'd walk out. And the amount of euphoric feeling I would have that I didn't buy anything was huge. I felt I succeeded. I feel like I kicked whatever little habit I might have had, right? I used to be addicted to buying books. God, I would go to the bookstore and geez, I'd just come away with two or three books constantly. Most of the time I had the time to explore the books and read them cover to cover, but there was a point where I bought so many books that I started having books that I'd barely read any pages in. And so when I started realizing, geez, I got to buy new bookshelves to hold these books, and I haven't even read, you know, of the new ones that I've bought, I haven't read even half of them. And that was more devastating to my personality and my character than anything else. So I just said, look, let's just stop until we get through these books. And then let's make sure that we actually need to read this stuff in the first place. And once you find out that a lot of books are full of crap anyway, you don't want to buy them anyway. It's all pop science crap, right? Bunch of lies about how the world works or something. But there's always a new scam out there, isn't there? There's always a new game that it will either play to your sort of keeping up appearances algorithm, which is you showing off to your neighbors or your friends. There's always a new version of that. And then there's ones that actually pull at your heartstrings. And I'm going to probably take a fairly unpopular view on this particular one, but it's one I've seen. It's consumed my friends. There are good people out there that love animals. And usually the people who love animals are some of the most wonderful people, if not the most wonderful people you can ever meet. If you're a guy and you want to find a good woman, if she's willing to take care of an animal, she's willing to take care of your ass. And likewise, they also have patience for things that don't go their way because animals are wild animals, right? But what's the game today? The game today is to rescue animals. And there's always an infinite supply of them, isn't there? It's always an infinite supply. There's always a stray animal walking around in public. People will pick these animals up and bring them home. And it's not that the person's bad for doing this. The fact they're showing their most inner empathy for a living being. And so they're essentially proving to society, you know, I'm a good person. But the problem is that it's a scam. And it's getting more and more intense. And people are trying to adopt more animals than they could possibly take care of. They start losing their own life because they can't leave the house because they've got six animals at home. When it gets to be a bad economy, they can't really afford to keep everything fed properly. When stress is hitting you, maybe the animal reduces their stress, maybe the animal increases their stress. But in the end, everyone suffers because everything gets out of moderation. It gets overwhelming. Anyone who's ever dealt with a veterinarian, you know that they sort of make up prices on the spot. You know, I had a friend of mine who had a cat, had an infected tooth. And she took the cat to the veterinarian and they said, well, the cat needs to have the tooth pulled and they need a shot right away to get rid of the pain. And they wanted to charge her $850 for the shot, right? And they wanted another like $600 or $700 to pull the tooth. And I watched her say, yeah, because we dropped the pet off and we went and ate lunch. We came back and then this big bill is sitting right there in front of her. And she essentially said, you know, I'm not going to pay that. That's ridiculous. You know, I will find someone else who will do this for a lot cheaper. And immediately they 50% of the bill. Immediately. Because they know their margin on that shot's probably, what, 15, 20 bucks? That's what they had to pay for the shot. And pulling the tooth creates, you know, you require the skill set of a doctor to do this properly. So, you know, maybe the doctor who's working, you know, 15 minutes to get the tooth out of the cat is consuming maybe, you know, if you paid them $200 to pull the tooth and you multiply that times the minutes in an hour, they're making, you know, $800 in an hour, moving to the next animal, right? So we have to be careful about what we rationalize as well, because sometimes it's geared right against your humanity. And they're going to say, look, if you don't spend this money, your pet is hurting and your pet is your child. You know, a buddy of mine had a dog that died of cancer very quickly, and it was just about the time that Chinese food came over with the cancer in the food. And his dog absolutely just went from completely healthy, running around Havasu, to dead. Before the dog died, he spent, I believe, no less than $9,000 trying to help the dog not have pain and all this other kind of stuff. And of course, we all love this dog. When this dog passed, we had a vigil before he passed, and I'm telling you, 80 people from around Los Angeles drove to this house to pet him for the last time. And that wasn't including the burial. If any of you have buried a relative, you know that the bills are insane for all the services. And they try to sell you every little thing. They'll try to sell you a card that's going to be passed out to people who see your relative. And they want, you know, the stationary bill online would have been $60, but they want to charge you $600. Because they're screwing you with your humanity and your feelings. So some of the consumerism that you have to get away from is going to be a defensive play on your part. You're going to have to anticipate who's going to be fair and who's not going to be fair. And sometimes these are things out of your control. If your pet gets sick, then, you know, it could be because consumerism-wise, you fed them food that was deemed okay because they have a really old brand that's been around for 60 years, but now that brand's buying their meat from China, which has carcinogens in it so bad that your pet dies. But if you'd saved money in other consumer areas, you could afford to feed your dog better food. It's this vicious cycle. So I'm interested in your opinions because I think we've all dealt with this. Some of us are dealing with this. And I think we all have to deal with it constantly because we need things to live. And, you know, I'm willing to bet a lot of you have become very creative with solving this problem. The transformations in your mind that you went from point A to point B, or some of you skipped over it completely. And I have to say, regardless of what group you're in, your lessons will help all of us. And so please, if you can, get down in the comments section and kind of help us all understand how you did it. And if you're stuck in it really badly and you need some help, then just, you know, anonymously just kind of say what's driving you nuts. Or you're having a problem. Maybe some of us can get in there and help. But I think you feel me. DeepThoughtsRadio.com for all the feeds. There's video on YouTube and vid.me. I forgot to mention this, but on vid.me, the nice thing about that is if you guys are interested in this show, we have very few views on the first season of the show because I used music from my music collection to open the show and close the show, and YouTube has a problem with digital rights in foreign countries, so a lot of the videos are blocked in foreign countries on YouTube. So if you go to vid.me, you're able to see season one in its pristine condition. I even fixed the intros on the first 12 episodes because I didn't have music at first and I had the wrong title on, I think, episode 7, which is a screenwriting episode. I think the credit says it's 8 or something like that. It's messed up, so I fixed that as well. For those of you who want to listen to this in your car, it's on iTunes or Google Play, or you can just go to deepthoughtsradio.com and click on the RSS feed and it will load up on your telephone, your favorite podcast listener. There's also a Patreon account, which folks are contributing to. So I want to say thank you to every single person who's on Patreon. Some of you asked me for a PayPal because you don't want to lose the tax that Patreon puts on you. I'm going to be putting that up at some point. So just keep your eyes open on that, and you'll see probably a PayPal link at the top. And, you know, it does help me put the show on. You know, I've had to switch out computers, which is the main thing. Don't worry about cigar costs. That's something I can take care of very easily here. But at some point, maybe this camera dies or something like that. I just would love to report that you guys made the show continue. I think that makes it more of our show instead of my show, you know. So anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.